Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today my guest will be Mariah Whitehead, who is the Petee River Basin and Winyah Bay Project Director for the Nature Conservancy. That's an awfully long title, but it also includes an area of almost 1 million acres, does it not, Mariah?
It does. It's a large area.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Mariah. I know you and I know your folks, but let our listeners know that your love of nature came from your childhood experiences.
It did. I had the great fortune of growing up on a family farm in the Petee region just outside of Florence. It was the farm and the home that my mom had grown up in. And I really grew up with a childhood outdoors. I had 3 brothers, so it was a rough and tumble childhood, catching frogs and snakes and riding horses, working in the yard, and just really enjoying lots of time in the great outdoors.
There's a wonderful picture of you in a magazine with a great horned owl sitting on your shoulder. What's that story? Because I think that tells a lot about your mom and dad and how they reared you children.
It does. And, you know, I really have to give all the credit to my mom for things like raising a great horned owl in our kitchen when we were kids. My grandfather had brought a great horned owl home that he had found in the woods when he had been hunting one morning. And it was right after a pretty large storm had blown through. So it looked like this owlet had been blown from its nest, but there were no signs of the nest around. And so we took the orphaned owl in and fed it chicken gizzards wrapped up with feathers in a playpen in our kitchen in my parents' home.
Was it a full-size owl when it came in?
It was not. It was a ball of feathers. It was a relatively small owlet, but it grew into a large, healthy, great horned owl. We eventually moved it outside into our screened-in sandbox, where we trained it on live mice, and eventually we released the owl back into the wild.
Owls have these huge talons, and here I'm seeing it looks like Mariah Whitehead at maybe 5 or 6 with this owl perched on your shoulder.
It was incredible. The owl was very gentle with us and would actually perch on our shoulders, would perch on my mom's head. After we released the owl, my mom could actually call it back. She would cut up some chicken gizzards and go outside. We named it Solomon the Great Horned Owl, and she would call, "Solly!" And here this huge owl would come out of the woods and land on my mom's shoulder or arm and let her feed it chicken gizzards.
So how long did this go on? Did he eventually go in back into the wild?
It did. Only as long, only for a few months, I think, until Solly found a mate and made its way back into the natural world.
Well, that's an incredible, beautiful story. I'm still trying to imagine Ida Whitehead with a great horned owl perched on her head.
Well, and I have to say, now with training as an ornithologist, I do not encourage this at home. This was back in the 70s, I think, before we knew that taking in live animals might not always be the best for them. And I think our story worked out well. But there are wonderful places now if you find an orphaned animal.
All right, but in those days, if you hadn't taken it in, it probably would have died.
Likely, yeah.
Now, one part of your career, and your career has been incredible since you left Davidson and then went to Clemson and then worked in Maui, but you were involved with saving raptors at one time, were you not?
That's right. And actually, my experiences at the Birds of Prey Center in Awandaw really were some of my formative early experiences with birds that sort of led me into that realm of science. And I worked with Jim Elliott at the Birds of Prey Center, first as a volunteer. Gosh, soon after the center opened, probably in about 1996 or 1997.
So just after you got out of college.
Just after I got out of college. And then I eventually became staff at the Birds of Prey Center as their director of research. I always made sure and I spent time in the clinic working directly with the injured birds when I was on staff there. But my job was really to help monitor and study raptor populations in the coastal plain of South Carolina.
Define raptors for us, in South Carolina anyway.
They are birds of prey, so birds with tearing beaks and taloned feet that really are hunters out there in the wild, some of our top predators.
Okay. Owls.
Owls.
Hawks. Ospreys.
Exactly. Eagles.
Eagles.
Sure. And the Birds of Prey Center would also take in vultures. And so we didn't want to leave behind. They're a little different as far as birds of prey go, but equally important.
Do vultures eat live? They usually just eat carrion, right?
They do. They do. They generally eat carrion.
Whereas the others do catch, whether it's mice or rabbits or...
Right. But we know that many of our birds of prey that go after live food are not too proud to take a nice, fresh, dead animal as well. And there's one bird of prey we haven't mentioned. It's the one that that I've been able to continue to study for the decade since I worked at the Birds of Prey Center, and that's the swallowtail kite.
Okay.
Kites are probably our most beautiful birds of prey in South Carolina, and they have a unique adaptation where they always feed on the wing. And so they'll catch their prey in the air and actually bring their feet to their mouth and eat while they're flying.
Now, describe the kites to us, because the others I'm very familiar with, but I'm not sure if I saw a kite, I'd know what I was looking
for. Sure. We have two kite species, the Mississippi kite and the swallowtail kite. The Mississippi kites are a little more ubiquitous. Both of the birds have about a 4-foot wingspan. The swallowtail kites are striking black and white birds, and they have a forked tail like a swallow. So when you see them, they're absolutely unmistakable. And many folks, rush to the computer to figure out what they've seen the first time they see a swallowtail kite.
Aren't one of those an endangered species?
Yeah. Swallowtail kites are endangered in South Carolina. So state endangered, but not on the federal endangered species list.
Okay. So the raptor experience was what eventually led you going to college and getting a graduate degree.
Well, the raptor experience was right there, kind of in the middle of some of those degrees. I had been to Davidson at that point and studied biology. And as you might imagine, a lot of my counterparts at Davidson had their sights set on the medical field. And there really weren't a whole lot of ecological sort of field courses at Davidson at that time. So my first jobs out of college, one was in Australia. I worked for an organization called the School for Field Studies and actually was the intern in charge of working with students that were interested in doing avian research in the rainforest in Australia. And it was after that that I came and back to Charleston and moved in with my brother, who was in med school at the time, and enrolled in an ornithology class at the College of Charleston because I said, this is it. I found it. Birds are where I want to be. And I started volunteering for the Birds of Prey Center at that point.
Okay. And eventually you got your PhD.
I did. I went on from there and pursued my master's at the University of Georgia and studied an interesting bird called the brown-headed cowbird and went straight into a PhD program at Clemson and actually studied with Drew Lanham there. And I'm guessing you've probably met with Drew at some point.
Yes. Yes. Then you ended up at the Nature Conservancy.
I did.
And you've been there since 2007.
That's right. And, you know, it was a hard decision to leave a really bird-specific job, which is what I was doing at the Birds of Prey Center. But when the position opened up at the Nature Conservancy, and I knew I was going to have the opportunity to continue my work in science and my work with birds, and specifically to continue working to protect habitats, which at that point I understood was the major threat to birds, was loss of native habitats. But I was going to be able to do all this in a place that my family had called home for 200 years. I knew it was going to be the perfect fit.
You've got a lot of territory to cover when we talk about the PD River Basin and Winyaw Bay. Winyaw Bay is, 120,000 acres, that part of it?
Sure, yes. It's a large project area. And the way the Nature Conservancy works is we work within these, what we might refer to as a conservation landscape, places that we think are vitally important to make investments in land protection and conservation. And we have five of those across the state. Four are in the coastal plain, and the Winyah Bay and Petey River Basin project area, or conservation area, is the northernmost of our coastal plain project areas.
Yeah. Ace Basin is...
Exactly. Yeah. Ace Basin was really the first conservation landscape where we were making significant investments in engaging landowners in private protection.
All right. And that, you know, that's the question that comes up when people start talking about conservation, land conservation. Some folks get real nervous. You're trying to tell me what to do with my property. But let's start with your home place, what your mom and dad did with that 200-year-old family farm in the Black River Swamp.
Absolutely. Well, I am very proud of my parents' decision and really our family's decision to place our family farm into a conservation easement. We worked with Petey Land Trust to accomplish that. I love the tagline that Petey Land Trust has, protecting the past and ensuring the future. They really see that dual role that conservation can play in protecting cultural landscapes and a way of life, and also protecting our natural systems for future generations.
Late Bill Chandler had something to do with that, I think, did he?
He did. He did. He was a wonderful advocate for Petey Land Trust and conservation in general.
So your folks have placed the family farm, been in your family, for your mother's family, for 200 years. Easements. Now, what does that mean?
I am so glad you asked that, because I have come to recognize there really is a lot of misunderstanding about what a conservation easement is. And I think it's interesting that you said, you know, some people do sort of bristle at this idea of, you know, you're going to suggest what I should do with my property. But I heard someone say recently, and I thought it was such an interesting take on the conservation easement as a tool and as an individual expression of what you'd like to see on your property, that it's actually the ultimate expression of private property rights. For someone to place their property in a conservation easement means that they get to say today what they would like the future of that land to be, even after they're gone. So a conservation easement is a legal tool that we can use for landowners to choose some rights that they might like to surrender that's going to affect the future of that property. Rights like the ability to subdivide the property, or the ability to mine the property for minerals. In some cases, they might choose to surrender the right to harvest timber in forested wetland areas. All of those rights have values that are tied to them. So a conservation easement allows us to value the land in your bundle of rights as they are today, and then to value the land with the rights that you've surrendered. And in that appraisal process, we look at the difference between those two values, and the difference becomes your conservation easement value.
So that conservation easement value is a tax write-off.
Exactly. So we have both federal and state tax incentives for landowners that are interested in engaging in a conservation easement.
Well, you mentioned a number of rights. I gather there is a list. You don't have to sign off on all of those.
Exactly. The purpose, the intent of the easement, and really the intent of the land trust groups that work with easement donors, is to tailor the easement to the landowner's long-term goals for the property.
Let's just take your family farm. What did your mom and dad sign away?
Well, they limited the number of future home sites that can be on the property and limited the number of times it could be subdivided. And it's really, the property is then dedicated to conservation purpose. And so you know that the long-term goals for the property are going to be aligned with these conservation purposes. Easements can also be aligned with working lands. So it can be perfectly compatible for a family farm where they intend to continue farming into the future, or for what we might call a working forest, where a landowner would like to see the property continue to be used to harvest timber. We work with landowners to develop forest management plans, and we would never encourage a landowner to say that they were absolutely going to, you know, make sure there was no future timber harvest on their uplands, and even to say that they would never use herbicides in the future, because we know now from decades of experience that active management, burning, and even sometimes the use of herbicides can be necessary to maintain our natural communities.
And, of course, the landscape of the PD, people marvel about Francis Marion and his men running around the PD, and they talk about the growth that's there now. But originally it was almost very park-like with very tall longleaf pines and a lot of open area. So that's how he could move by horseback so quickly.
Exactly.
not with the tangle of second growth that's come up.
And, you know, I think it's important to note that putting a property into protection is really only the first step in conserving a property, making sure that we steward that property. You mentioned longleaf pine, actually making sure that we're helping to restore and steward longleaf pine in South Carolina as the native habitat that we saw on our uplands in the coastal plain. We used to have 13 million acres of longleaf in South Carolina and over 92 million in the southeast, and that's been reduced range-wide to about 3 million acres. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and we found out from natural disasters, whether it's ice or hurricane, things like slash pines aren't always the best thing. They may grow fast, but they're not always the best things to be.
Exactly, and there are some soils where really the longleaf pine are going to outperform almost any other pine in our sandy, dry soils.
Oh. Yes. The sand hills here in the middle of the state, longleaf will do just fine.
Yep, exactly.
So, anyway, let's get on with the whole idea of conservation, because the organization that you work for, the Nature Conservancy, and there are other organizations that partner with you, like the Land Trust Alliance and the PD Land Trust and Ducks Unlimited,
right?
The hunters, who are very interested in preserving the natural habitat. But you've been with the Conservancy now for 8 years, and you've seen it grown, I think, to several hundred thousand acres in your particular area?
That's right. That's right. So it's an interesting thing to look at the way we've invested in land protection across the state. Across South Carolina, about 8% of our entire land mass is in some form of protection. And the Nature Conservancy has actually been involved in protecting over 330,000 acres in South Carolina. We hold about 150 easements across the state. But I often call my project area sort of the Wild West of land protection. You know, we see some coastal counties like Charleston with 30% of the land in a protected status. And up in the Winyah Bay River Basin, the total protected status is closer to 10%. There's still plenty of work to be done on that front. And really, a lot of the opportunity there is engaging with some of our former industrial forest lands. So much of the land up in the landscape was formerly owned by International Paper or Mead Westvaco. We've got hundreds of thousands of acres in these industrial forest lands that, you know, really are a large part of the land base that we might be able to work with.
Well, aren't those companies beginning to divest themselves of their tree farms?
Exactly, exactly. So a lot of those companies have divested. We've seen a lot of change in ownership over the last few years. And often, if they see an opportunity for an outsale for real estate, if they see that the land might hold high real estate value, a lot of those lands are being sold off to different interests.
There's one success story that has been highlighted by the Nature Conservancy, and that's Magnificent Mansfield. So you want to tell us about the Parkers and Magnificent Mansfield?
Absolutely. It's maybe one of my favorite projects I've had the opportunity to to work on, because the goals of our organization and the Parker family were so aligned, and I really did learn a lot by working with the Parkers on this particular project. You know, this was not a project where the Nature Conservancy went and knocked on the door of the Parkers and said, you know, we really think you guys should consider a conservation easement. The Parkers knew about easements as a tool for protecting property and had been considering it, as my dad did, for years. Mm-hmm. And it's a big decision, and often it takes a landowner a little while to arrive at the decision that it is indeed time to move forward. So I got the call from Mr. Parker saying, you know, I've decided that 2013 is the year to protect Mighty Mansfield, and I'm talking to some different groups about how to do that. So I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with John Parker about the history of Mansfield, which I think might be one of the most fascinating histories of ownership that I've ever heard.
Well, let's talk about that. Share that.
Yeah. Well, John Parker's ancestor, Susanna Mann, actually was a widowed woman in 1755, and she purchased a little over 500 acres along the banks of the Black River in Georgetown County.
Let me just add a historical note here, because people might say, we didn't think women could do that in the 18th century, that only men. But she was a widow, which meant that she had the legal right to purchase property and so forth. If she had been married, her husband would have been involved. If she were widowed, if she's single, or if she were in business and married, she could get a document filed with the court that she was a femme sole, which meant that she could then buy goods and trade and what have you. But that was, she had to get that legally. Her husband had to sign off on that.
Wow. How fascinating.
But Miss Mann was...
Miss Mann became a very successful rice planter. And Mansfield actually grew under her ownership to over 700 acres. The property stayed in rice cultivation, and at that time, as you know, Georgetown became just a booming center for rice production. Mm-hmm. And there are fascinating stories about the Parkers' ancestors' history with rice. One of the family members was trained as a physician but decided to become a planter instead and apply his scientific mind to the planting and cultivation of rice, and he started experimenting with different fertilizers and actually figured out that bat dung was one of the best fertilizers out there and was able to increase his crop yields way above his other neighbors in the Plantersville district. Mansfield was one of about 25 rice plantations, and as you know, it was just perfectly situated in this tidal zone of the Winya Bay River Basin, where the push and the pull of the tide was there daily to supply the rice fields with the water they needed. But it was the fresh water moving up and back. The salt wedge really wasn't reaching these areas where the planters were cultivating rice. The plantation stayed in rice cultivation even up to the time of the Civil War. In the late 1800s, there were a series of devastating storms that, mm-hmm. that hit the Georgetown area. And between 1880, I think, is that right, Walter? And the early 1900s, several of these storms had really caused the demise of the...
Yes, people think about the great hurricane of 93, which is 1893, which the Beaufort area. But as George Rogers, in his History of Georgetown County, chronicles, Georgetown was the rice production center of the state, and the storms in the last two decades of the 19th century pretty much ended it. A few struggled on, and I think Mansfield actually did struggle into the 20th
it did.
Century.
It struggled on and eventually looked to the uplands to create some income. The large longleaf pine that was there was harvested. You know, they really did what they could to hold on to the property and keep it in the family. But in, I believe, 1912, they finally decided to sell Mansfield, and they sold it to a northern family that was buying it as a recreational property.
Which happened to, I think, almost the majority of the plantations in Georgetown County was sold as hunting lodges to rich folks from up north.
Exactly. There could be a book on how northern industrialists saved the South.
Right? Well, actually, there's some folks who have written on that. And, of course, if they were interested in hunting, they're right in the Atlantic Flyway
exactly.
for ducks.
So it became all the fad to have one of these duck plantations. And those rice fields and the incredible ingenuity that was applied to actually creating those then became, you know, a central infrastructure for managing waterfowl impoundments.
And then that lasted for about 50 or 60 years. And then those families lost interest, began to sell off.
Exactly.
People don't realize that, for example, it's not in Georgia, but the Dodge family for years had a place in South Carolina, actually down at Edisto. Mm. But you could mention the industrial magnates of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and a lot of them had a place in South Carolina on the coast. So Mansfield's no longer going to be a hunting lodge. How do the Parkers get back in control?
Well, it eventually sold back into a South Carolina family. Another family, the Montgomerys, owned it after the Tuttles, and then there was one more ownership after the Montgomerys. And then in 2004, Mansfield came up on the market. And at that time, John Parker, I believe, had vowed if he had ever had the opportunity to purchase Mansfield and bring it back into the family, that he would do everything in his power to do that. And that opportunity came, and he made it happen. So in 2004, he and Sally purchased Mansfield, and it had been out of the family for 92 years.
So it's back in the family, and do they live there?
They actually, at that point, Mansfield had become a bed and breakfast. And so they decided to continue the bed and breakfast business. They have a home there, but they also have a home and a business in Asheville. So they successfully split their time between Asheville and Mansfield and beat the road back and forth, I think, at least a few times a month.
Well, that's not an easy direct commute.
Exactly.
Just getting to Georgetown from Columbia is not an easy commute.
Right.
So how many acres are we talking about now have they assembled?
The easement is over 800 acres. So all of the historic plantation is within the conservation easement. And they have some additional acreage that is not yet within the conservation easement. But well over 800 acres are in these.
I think that's when you talked about, because the historic plantation was 700 acres
exactly.
that the widow man was able to put together. So that really you've got two centuries plus actually working on 250 years.
Right.
And are the abandoned rice fields still there?
They are. The rice fields are still there, and the rice fields are one of many things that the Parkers have invested in, restoring and maintaining over the years. So they've maintained those historic dikes and trunks that allow them to continue to use the rice fields as they had been in the past. They are not cultivating rice, but they can cultivate waterfowl to some extent. And really that we see that across the board in Mansfield. The Parkers are as committed to restoring the historic structures on site as they are the natural communities. And they're actively engaged in restoring a historic slave village on site and also restoring longleaf pine.
I think part of that, the slave street, would have been a chapel, which I think that's already been restored.
That's right. The chapel is beautiful. And I did, when I was out there working on the baseline report, one of my coworkers and I walked into the chapel as part of the process of documenting all the structures on the property. And it is a spiritual place. It is absolutely beautiful what they've done with the chapel. And what I find really unique about the Parkers' approach, they've placed the slave village, about 15 acres, around the village into a foundation trust. And so the Parker Family Foundation leases that space. And so they are actively working to acquire the funds through the foundation to do a full restoration. The foundation board includes two descendants of enslaved African Americans that lived on Mansfield that are helping to direct that project and make those investments. I've felt through this experience of protecting Mansfield, it was one of the most significant experiences I've had in recognizing the role that conservation can play in protecting our cultural resources and our history.
Mariah, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Mariah Whitehead of the Nature Conservancy. How do you spend your day? Where are you based?
My home is actually in Brevard, North Carolina. And I moved up there about 3 years ago when my husband took his job up there. And so I have the distinct privilege of still being able to work in my home landscape of Winyah Bay. And I work remotely from home. And when I'm not working remotely, I'm down in usually the Georgetown area at my grandfather's old fishing cabin on Mingo Creek. And that's my home away from home.
I see you your photographs come out. You're always kayaking. So is that just something you're doing on it, or are you leading?
It is a landscape of rivers. So the Winyah Bay area is the convergence of five rivers. And it's hard to stumble outdoors without running into a creek or river. And I look for every opportunity to get out on those rivers and out on the landscape. I'm often meeting with landowners, and I also really enjoy taking people out to enjoy some of these beautiful rivers that we have within that landscape.
Now, within this area, is there a first growth of cypress trees?
Yeah, so there are some incredible cypress resources along some of these river systems. You know, we're really fortunate that we do have very much intact forested wetland systems throughout the coastal plain of South Carolina and specifically in this Winyah Bay landscape. And we have areas that are old growth cypress. And some of that old growth millennial cypress might be some of the most important to protect. I've had the opportunity to work with and meet with a dendrochronologist from the University of Arkansas, Dr. Stolle, who's been studying some of these millennial cypress along the Black River in Williamsburg and Georgetown County for about three decades. And he will really just go on and on about the amount of information that's housed in these trees that have been around for 1,000 years, that there's so much to learn from them.
Such as
our climate history and the history, the hydrologic history of the area. It tells us about droughts and times of stress with water and also times when the salt water made it well up the system. So just a wealth of information on...
Well, how do you figure out salt water?
It's incredible. There's so much information captured in isotopes and in tiny gas bubbles that we can get through a core sampling process. And so these standing cypress, you know, don't need to be cut down to get this information. They can use core samples and take really just a plug out of the tree to be able to pull out a lot of that information.
So now how large round? I'm looking at a pencil here, a good old number two pencil. Is that about the size?
About
the size of the core sample.
That's right.
And that goes all the way through to the tree?
You would try to get right into the center of the tree. Obviously, a lot of these old trees have lost their heart. And so you might lose some information at the center of the tree. But you get as far into the tree as possible to pull out that information.
And then you mentioned gas bubbles, and I guess that's modern technology can find that.
Exactly.
So that's a lot more sophisticated than us scouts counting the rings.
Right.
On a tree that somebody had cut down so he could count the rings.
And the Black River has been a special place for the Nature Conservancy in the past few years. It's a place that I did have a personal tie with. We had a family cabin on Mingo Creek when I was a child, which is just a creek off of the Black River. It's one of our coastal plain rivers, and that's the reason it runs black. It has hardwood component, and those trees act just like a tea bag and actually dye the river a color similar to tea, but when you look at it, it appears black from above. The river is about 150 miles, but 75 miles of that is a state scenic river. And it's a place where there's still large parcel size family ownership, a lot of intact forested wetlands, and the potential for longleaf restoration on the uplands. Landowners with a true sense of place and stewardship ethic.
Okay. Now, people think about the coast and they immediately think about the Santee River Basin, but that's a separate.
That's a separate basin, exactly. Okay. So the Black River is actually part of the PD Basin, part of that tremendous, almost 7 million acre basin. At the end of the day, the PD reaches all the way up into Virginia.
Yeah, the Yadkin.
Yes, exactly. The Yadkin PD system is a tremendous system, and the Black River is really just a coastal offshoot of that system, all contained within South Carolina.
If somebody wanted to get in touch, let's just say, I want to know more about what this project, you know, how do you go about doing something like this?
Sure. Well, we do often hear from landowners that have frequently heard from their peers. And, you know, I do think the message about what you might do with your land or opportunities for conservation easements can be best peer-to-peer. For someone to hear from a friend and hear about their experience of how they came to the decision to place their property in permanent protection. So we often hear from people who may have heard from a friend or a relative about how to go about protecting their land. Sometimes they say they want to protect it for their children, and sometimes they want to protect it from their children.
Well, I understand that, but I have had friends say that they were, and this is in a different part of the state, that they were not sure what their children would do with the property.
Exactly. And I think this ties back to the conversation we were just having about really allowing our children those experiences to immerse in the natural world and to develop and experience a sense of place, because at the end of the day, you protect what you love and you love what you understand.
But if somebody gets in touch with you through the peers, then there's a process, a document is created, which then is registered to the county courthouse.
Exactly. The conservation easement document is a legal document that follows the land forever, no matter who owns it in the future. So it's a big decision to think about those rights that you might like to surrender that are going to allow that property to be the way you envision it to be into the future. So landowners often think carefully about that, and we've learned a lot of lessons, I would say, in the land trust community about how to help them think through that process of what they'd like to see in an easement document.
So I really like what you said about frequently. I mean, you're not down there in your kayaks getting up to somebody's dock and going knocking on the door and say, how about give us a land easement? This is really, as you say, someone who's done it then becomes the missionary, if you will, or the emissary for the process. And it doesn't necessarily have to be through the Nature Conservancy. It could be through Ducks Unlimited.
Exactly.
As you say, there are any number of groups who are allied with you in this 7 million acre area.
Right. There are many wonderful groups to work with. Sometimes folks already have a relationship with an organization, say like Ducks Unlimited, and there's no doubt in their mind that that's who they would like to hold their easement. I think we're unique in South Carolina in just having a really close-knit group of folks that work together in the land trust community and in the conservation community. Part of that was cultivated first through the Ace Basin Project. The Ace Basin was one of the first private land protection initiatives in the country, and the groups really came together to talk about shared priorities and shared resources on how they could accomplish that. So I think it's one of the three things I often say that we're most fortunate in South Carolina and the world of conservation is our close working relationships with other conservation groups.
And in one of the publications that I always check up on my guests. One of the publications, it mentioned your partners, American Rivers, Ducks Unlimited, Low Country Open Land Trust, North Inlet, Winyaw Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve, PD Land Trust, South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, Waccamaw National Wildlife Refuge, and the Waccamaw Riverkeeper. So you've got public, private.
State.
Right.
We do. And, you know, several of these what we might call legacy landscapes or conservation landscapes where we've decided to make significant investments in conservation have modeled after the Ace Basin and developed task force groups. So that list that you just named are actually the partners that I sit down with through the Winyaw Bay Task Force to talk about conservation opportunities, to leverage each other's resources to bring more conservation funding to the area, to talk about threats. And it is, I think, just a really successful model in South Carolina that's helped us get where we are.
Now, I heard from your brother Weave that you on a field trip or a kayaking trip in the swamp, and that's where you found your family dog. Now, is that true?
It is a true story. It is. I was on a paddle trip on the Black River, and it was just over a year ago. It was last April, and we were paddling along, and it was actually one of the folks that was accompanying us saw a little white animal standing on an overturned cypress tree just off the channel of the river. And she paddled in closer to see what it was, and it was a really emaciated white hound dog that had somehow found its way on this to be perched on this cypress tree looking totally terrified of the water all around it.
You do have alligators in the river, right?
There are a few alligators. We don't see too many alligators quite that far up the Black River, but occasionally we see one. So maybe that's why this poor dog was looking so terrified. We managed to get the dog into the kayak, coaxed her in with a bag of cashews, and paddled her back to safety. And she ended up coming home with me and is our family dog and appropriately named River.
And she's just a hound dog.
She is just a hound mix and just a delightful, thankful dog.
Well, looking back over your career as someone who's been involved with the natural environment really since your college days, what maybe was one of the most interesting experiences or funny experiences other than rescuing the hound? I think that's a really sweet story. But, you know, you may have had something that, what about a terrifying experience?
I've had quite a few experiences in the natural world and through my work as an ornithologist. I love to horrify people with the story of one of my more in-depth research projects I did at the Birds of Prey Center. I got to work with a team of scientists, and we were studying the impacts of a pharmaceutical drug that was decimating old world vultures. And we were looking at the impacts on new world vultures. And I had the opportunity, or somehow drew the short straw, to be the one that was in charge of catching the vultures every time we needed to administer this pharmaceutical. And if you've never encountered a vulture when they feel threatened, you might not know what their natural defense is, but it turns
they throw up.
They do. So, having been vomited on by a vulture many times, I think I am ready for most encounters in the natural world.
Let's get back to the Nature Conservancy and any special projects you're working on right now.
You know, we are continuing this work along the Black River. I have four or five active projects right now in that reach of the landscape. We've talked a lot about land protection today, but as I mentioned at the beginning, protection is really just the first step in conservation. So we're actively engaged right now in a project to expand outreach for longleaf restoration and prescribed fire. And we're doing that into the Winya Bay landscape. And that's a natural outgrowth out of an existing conservation area that surrounds the Francis Marion National Forest. The Francis Marions really are a stronghold for longleaf pine right now. So we're looking forward to engaging with private landowners to help them find resources to be able to burn on their land, and if they're interested, to be able to engage in longleaf restoration. The Nature Conservancy is also one of the only groups that's work reaches out into the ocean. So I get to work directly with some of our marine staff. Oyster restoration is one of the things that the Nature Conservancy is engaged in. We've done some of that work in the Winya Bay landscape, but most recently have partnered with Low Country Open Land Trust to place some oyster restoration projects on some of their conservation easement lands. I mean, talk about a cultural resource that is worth investing in. I mean, we all enjoy a great Low Country oyster roast.
Absolutely. Now, oysters on our coast, we think of clusters. 17th century colonists talk about oysters where the meat was as large as their hand.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we were really fortunate in South Carolina that in certain places, including Bulls Bay, we've got up to 50% of the original oyster population still intact. That is about as good as it gets. And, of course, we'd like to see that grow to you know, even more of the historic population. A lot of the times, it's just making sure that we're putting the oysters back into those areas where they've been, that we're supplying the shell and giving the young oysters a place to grow.
That's one thing that has changed. I mean, growing up on the Gulf Coast and when I first came to South Carolina, crushed oyster shells is what people used in their driveways.
Exactly.
Don't do that anymore.
Right. We want our shells back in our estuarine system. We want to see those shells back in the oyster beds, helping to promote young oysters and allowing that system to thrive and grow. And there's so many benefits that oysters bring, you know, aside from the resources, just an incredible food that we get to take part of. They are actively filtering water and help to promote clean water around our marshes and in that marsh environment, which we know is the nursery ground for really all our fisheries.
The shrimp in particular.
Yep. Shrimp and crab and fish all really depend on that, our native reef system, our oyster reef system, to help propagate their young. And that reef system is holding our salt marsh system in place as well.
And, of course, the wetlands further up, the swamps serve as natural filters.
Exactly. Exactly. It's all connected. So having our forested wetlands intact and helping to filter that water as it comes downstream is vitally important as it enters the estuarine zone.
Mariah, Alfred is giving me the wind-up sign. Any last words for our listeners before we sign off today?
You know, one thing I didn't mention that I think is worth mentioning is that we are really fortunate in South Carolina. I think we have three things that just set us apart from our neighboring states and from other areas as far as conservation goes. One of those is landowners with a land ethic and a connection to the land and to the natural world. Really intact natural resources, intact natural systems that are worthy of protection, And then the third thing that I mentioned, these close-knit conservation partnerships out there on the ground helping to carry the work forward. There's a lot left to be done, but I think we're very fortunate that we have what we have.
Mariah Whitehead, Project Director for the Nature Conservancy in the Pedee River Basin and Winyaw Bay. Thanks for being with us today on the Journal.
Thank you.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's Journal. Mariah Whitehead was a fascinating guest, and we always wonder, how does one begin a particular career? She grew up in a family where love of nature was a part of everyday life, from raising a great horned owl in her mother's kitchen to rescuing a dog in the Black River Swamp. Mariah Whitehead has spent her entire adult life trying to save or help others save the natural beauty of South Carolina for future generations. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of the Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.